Lots of celebration still happening. Maybe a little bit groggy-eyed here on this Friday afternoon. Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson, in for Phil Latzman. Plenty of celebration going on throughout South Florida, from Hialeah to the Bayside to Miami Beach, from Homestead up to Fort Lauderdale, maybe as far north as Palm Beach, if they're true Heat fans here after celebrating the second consecutive NBA championship, taking their fans to the limit on Game 7. We'll talk about that. We'll talk about the job market in the Sunshine State and the George Zimmerman murder trial getting underway officially next week with opening statements. This week, our panel of championship journalists joining us from South Dade County, Greg Allen, the NPR correspondent based in Miami. Derek Hamm, political and capital reporter from the Palm Beach Post with us from the capital city in Tallahassee, and Doug Hanks from the Miami Herald covering business and economics. Welcome, one and all. Greg, let's begin with you in South Dade County. You've been able to wipe the championship from your eyes here and join us, join reality again?
Sure have, Tom. Thanks for having me on again today. Great night last night for everybody here in Miami, and we have a lot of answers to hand back to our friends from around the country. I don't think there's a lot of sympathy or celebrating for the heat that goes on outside of Florida. We're one of those teams that a lot of people seem to not like so much, but maybe we'll win some over with this new championship.
You love to hate them. What about in the capital city or even in Palm Beach County here, Dara? Does the Heat championship rise up throughout South Florida, even up into the panhandle?
You know, it might, but I wouldn't be the guy to tell you about it because I had no idea until I was reading the preparation for the show today that the Heat had even won. But I did do some research, and I do have a tweet that the governor sent out congratulating the Miami Heat. And here's the tweet here, the governor, Rick Scott, at FLGovScott, for anybody who wants to follow him. Congrats to the at Miami Heat on an incredible season and for keeping the NBA championship where it belongs, the Sunshine State. Pound NBA champs.
Well, perhaps your lack of knowledge with the championship is noteworthy, considering you are in the panhandle. And maybe, Doug, the Miami Heat is a Miami phenomenon, like Greg says.
Well, I think so. Like they said, people love to hate the Heat.
Yeah, and how about that, Greg? I mean, if this is a championship that's solely for Miami, not for the entire area of South Florida, how does this play when we take a look, for instance, at some of the economic incentives and some of the economic impact that these kinds of big national, if not global, sporting events can have on a local community?
Well, you know, Tom, your dog will be much better on this than I am. But what I would say about this is that, you know, it's one of these things that when we talk to economists, they a lot of times they say a sports team really does not bring money to a region. But on one hand, that's on one hand. But on the other hand, the impact is incalculable. You know, and you can pick and choose who you listen to on this. But, you know, the fact remains, for people in Miami, there's a lift in everybody's step today. It's got to have a positive impact. Now, maybe that's not something you can put a dollar sign to. But a lot of people around the country, around the world, see Miami as a world-class city. And having a championship team go to the finals, 3 in the last 5 years,
yep,
that doesn't hurt. You know, so I think this is a very positive, you know, from that point of view.
Doug, how about it? Forget about the intangible. What about the tangible? You're very familiar with these arguments because you're on the front lines of them. Do they hold any water? Is there any validity to this?
Well, I was thinking about coming to the studio today. I think the only thing that unifies a city typically is going to be tragedy, disaster, or a sports victory. And right now, the Heat are the only ones delivering. And for sure, it's incalculable. It brings a city together, and you can't put a dollar amount on it. But boy, do those sports teams try. Because all of them have their hands out saying, we need some government help to keep this this mania alive. And we're certainly seeing it from the Heat, as well as the Marlins successful, the Dolphins failed, and the Heat trying to get a little bit more.
Yeah. And Dara, it brings in politics. I mean, the governor, you mentioned his congratulatory tweet to the Miami Heat. How does this play in the State House when these large sports entities come with their hand out?
Well, we saw how it played this last session. You know, not very well on the part of the Dolphins. I think that the legislature now is very wary of giving out tax breaks or tax incentives or free money to sports teams because and in part because of the salaries of the players, and in a state where Floridians have been out of work or struggling to make ends meet, and the legislature has been cutting the budget every year for 6 years up until this year, you know, it just doesn't seem fair to a lot of people who aren't directly in those communities.
Yeah, we've got the phone lines open. The emails are up and rolling, as well as the Twitter. Questions and comments welcome for our panel here on the Florida Roundup. We've got the phone number at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Email thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. And feel free to tweet us. Use the call sign at WLRN. Perhaps the best kind of endorsement that these kinds of teams, best kinds of spokespeople these kinds of championship seasons can have are the stars themselves. And LeBron James perhaps rolling out his own bit of red carpet last night.
The vision that I had when I decided to come here is all coming true. You know, through adversity, through everything we've been through, we've been able to persevere and to win back-to-back championships, it's an unbelievable feeling, and I'm happy to be part of such a first-class organization.
Doug, you wrote a piece about a week ago in the Miami Herald talking about how the Heat already has come back to local governments with their hand out, trying to extend the lease, looking for some public subsidies. Does the championship trophy help their argument? Does that get them a better audience?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a big part of the argument. And their argument is, listen, we are investing in this team. As you can see, we have the hottest athlete in sports. And we started with the public as a partner, and we want to continue it, and we're going to probably require some more investment from the public. But you, as the Dolphins will tell you, winning really helps the political argument.
The Marlins will tell you something as well.
And the Marlins, too. And, you know, the championship win is great, but boy, wasn't it awkward when the Miami Heat fans were leaving during Game 6, and that really got some national attention.
Right.
And really touches on a weak spot for Miami, which is the fair weatherness of fans. And the teams will tell you that really hurts their ability to sustain their revenues.
But, you know, if I could, Tom, I'd like to, you know, to turn it on to the owners and talk about the class of Mickey Arison last night, watching him with the trophy, you know, thanking everyone, making sure to point out how great the San Antonio Spurs were and their organization. That's an owner who's consistently shown class the way he's helped build the team. He, in some ways, deferred to the players. When the players mm-hmm. put this deal together that brought the big three to Miami, some owners have egos that might not allow that to happen. And then you compare him on one hand with Jeff Loria from the Marlins, the other hand, and I think that says a lot about the way they're going to be viewed in the community.
Well, one is viewed as an absentee owner. The other one is viewed as a member of the community. Right, Greg?
Right, and you know there was the Carnival, you know, Performing Arts Center. They came forward, you know, to pay for that before the Carnival Corporation did, which of course Mickey Arison is one of the owners of. You know, before, I mean, he's got ties to the community, and plus he built a winning team, and you don't hear any talk about him dismantling it now.
No, go
forward, right?
Yeah, winning does change pretty much everything. But what are the economics that the Heat are arguing for the new public investment that they'd like to see in the AAA, Doug?
Well, they come to this to the county and say, listen, we are the number one entertainment destination for downtown Miami. That's really no question about that. Well, Bayside, but it's certainly up there.
Sure. There's not a lot of competition, though, for entertainment dollars.
No, but that helps strengthen, although the museums are coming, et
They're
cetera.
Coming
and by
along,
the way, they want the same source of hotel taxes that the Heat want. So it'll be interesting to see that play out. And they're saying, listen, Miami wants to be a world-class city. Obviously, an NBA team is part of that. We've been through this before with the Miami Arena. It seems like ancient history. But if you let these places go,
right,
you're left with a very awkward situation like the Dolphins are facing. The Dolphins spent the year saying where we play is not a world-class facility. And now they're stuck with it.
Yeah.
The Heat say they do not want to be in that situation.
Isn't there a bitter taste in voters, in the local voters' mouths over the whole Dolphin deal? I mean, how does that help or hurt the Heat?
Well, I don't. You talk to Miami-Dade insiders, and they say we're not anxious to have another conversation about sports taxes. But it's also interesting that when you look at the Dolphins, yes, they ran into a roadblock in the House. But, man, they got support from the Senate. Mm-hmm. They got support from the governor. Mm-hmm. They got quick support from Miami-Dade County Commission, which was most directly impacted from the Marlins fallout, from the recall, et cetera. So I think when you look at the establishment is ready to support these sports teams getting more public dollars. And if forced to go to the public, that's when things run into trouble.
And Dare, I'm wondering from your perspective, you know, at least here in South Florida, for those that are able to dig into what happened with the failure of the Dolphins to secure state funding, it was really seen more of a failure of the Dolphins to understand the legislative process as opposed to the argument on its own merits.
Right. I think, you know, they had one of the most skillful lobbyists in the state of Florida, Ron Book. I don't think that you can underestimate his knowledge of how the legislature operates. I think this was really – and there have been – I understand that that is an accusation. I think that, you know, I was just thinking that the House Speaker, Will Weatherford, is a former college football player. And so, you know, if he didn't sign off on a tax break for a football team, you know, I'm not sure he's going to sign off on a tax break for a basketball team. But that maybe me not being a sports fan underestimating the significance of this heat win. I just think that there's a, you know, there is in the House, there's skepticism towards giving away money to companies, to sports teams that have, you know, billionaire owners and athletes that make these, you know, large sums of money when they have been cutting services mm-hmm. to all folks across the board for 6 years. I think that was part of it. It sends, you know, they're concerned about, you know, the perception of who's getting favors.
But what the teams will say and what Carlos Jimenez in Miami-Dade County said is, listen, we give cash to businesses all the time to create jobs and whatnot.
Look at the incentives being offered to Amazon.com.
Absolutely. And look until they just cut it off. But man, you know, $5 million a year to Burn Nose, the television mm-hmm. show. And so let's, when these teams, which perhaps occupy a unique part of the economy and entertainment and tourism industry, ask for money, let's look at it from an economic development standpoint and say we're already giving this money away to private enterprise. Why not the teams as well?
All right. That's Doug Hanks, business writer and reporter extraordinaire for the Miami Herald. Greg Allen, national correspondent for National Public Radio based in South Florida, is along with us. And Dara Kam with the Palm Beach Post, political reporter with us from Tallahassee. Dara mentioning the optics of looking at these sports subsidies with struggling employment numbers. We did get some new state employment numbers for the state of Florida. The unemployment rate dropped, but so did the number of new jobs. We'll talk about that and how that shines a light on the 2014 political cycle, all ahead here on the Florida Roundup. It's the Florida Roundup here on WLRN, our championship group of journalists from throughout the state of Florida. Doug Hanks from the Miami Herald, Greg Allen, NPR in South Florida, and Dara Kam from the Palm Beach Post with us from Tallahassee. So, guys, we saw some new state employment numbers here today. The unemployment rate in the state of Florida continuing to drop, 7.1%, the lowest it's been since September of 2008. Considerably lower still, Greg, than the national unemployment rate. What do you make of this number here, Greg?
Well, you know, things are clearly getting better here. You know, we have so many other problems here besides unemployment. Of course, that is certainly the biggest one if you don't have a job. But housing is still lagging here. We have basically a lack of diversified industry in some ways. There are these kind of structural issues. But you know, this has got to be good news, certainly for Rick Scott. He's making making a notice of it anytime it comes along. And the Republican Party has sent out a press release today talking about growth under Scott versus decline under Charlie Crist. Remember Charlie Crist? Well, we hear about him every day from the Republican Party. So at least they think it's good news, and they want to portray him as a good governor next to Charlie Crist for some reason.
Well, we're still positioning for that 2014 election cycle after all, Greg, where Governor Crist may come back into the headlines again. Dara, what about in Tallahassee? How are these job numbers being played out here on this Friday?
Right. So the governor is, you know, very excited about this as not, the Florida unemployment numbers continue to decline. They sent out in their press release with the announcement of these numbers today a graphic that shows a chart with the U.S. unemployment number and the Florida unemployment number since the governor took office. And you can see that the disparity was quite wide. Florida's was much higher. Mm-hmm. When he took office, and now Florida's has gone and dipped below and continues to decline while the national. So in a sense, it's almost like, you know, the governor is running against President Obama. And in some ways, I was talking to one of Charlie Crist's consultants yesterday who says, you know, the governor wants to blame Charlie Crist for the global economic meltdown. Well, certainly, you know, he seems to be running against Obama and Charlie Crist with these unemployment numbers, which are very good for him.
So the data does a great job of kind of telling us the big overall trend, but it's you need to put a voice to some of the data. Tamara from Miami here joins us. She's with the Public Insight Network here on WLRN. Tamara, you're employed but looking for work. So when you hear that the unemployment rate is dropping in the state of Florida, does that give you confidence?
Well, I mean, good morning, everybody, or good afternoon. It does, as far as other people are concerned, because what I believe those numbers reflect are maybe certain types of jobs that are maybe more blue collar or certain, a little further down the job scale that what I'm looking for, being a seasoned professional with more than 20 years experience, four languages, and a slew of other skills and qualifications that I certainly have not found it easy at all. I've been looking for a job for 3 years. So, yes, I mean, the numbers overall can definitely show that there's been a certain recovery. I just would be curious to see a little bit more of the segmented, you know, breakup of where those jobs are being created and what type of jobs are being created.
Yeah, sure. And in fact, what we see is when we look at the jobs that are not being created, Doug, we see still cutbacks in construction statewide and still cutbacks with state workers, government workers. Those are two areas that we're seeing jobs decrease. And to Tamara's point, what are you seeing inside these job numbers in terms of those high quality, higher paying work for Floridians?
Right. You know, the finance industry blew a big hole in the economy. Those are good paying jobs. We're still struggling with that. Tourism and retail were a major part of the of the recovery. And like you said, the government sector, that is, that in Miami-Dade County, that's the number one drag on the hiring rebound. The number one anchor is local government positions.
Greg, how about it from your perspective, traveling throughout the state? What's your sense of confidence of Floridians in this job market?
Well, you know, it seems to me, and I would, you know, I know consumer confidence is rising as well, so
pretty
it
good.
Shows that people are thinking, you know, thinking things are getting better. But you know, it's that government hiring thing is an issue. You know, I mean, what we're talking about in Broward about possible layoffs there in the sheriff's department.
Right.
And, you know, we've had, you know, there's always a threat of education cuts coming down the line too. You know, so if until we actually figure out a way to diversify our economy, bring in more manufacturing, bring in other kinds of good-paying jobs, we're going to be – the main driver is going to continue to be the public sector, I think, throughout Florida, especially South Florida.
And Dara, then, what kind of audience is that getting with state legislators as they go home to those districts here over the summer? What are they hearing back?
Well, I wanted to go back to the state workforce because one of the things that the governor has bragged on – in all of these charts and is the decline in the number of state employees since he took office. And I thought it was really telling. He had a press conference out at the Emergency Operations Center where they were working on a hurricane, you know, study practice. And it was the center of this big giant state worker complex. And he was talking to us and he said, you know, Florida has the smallest state worker workforce in the country. And I'm proud of that. And I thought, geez, what an odd place to make that statement.
Yeah.
But, you know, he is wanting to shrink government. And in the same time, he's trying to expand manufacturing. The legislature just signed off on one of his two priorities, which was a tax break for manufacturing equipment. They seem to have backed away from this doing away with the corporate sales tax, which was something that he ran on and they moved towards in his first years, but didn't do anything on this year. So, you know, again, the governor's focus is on shrinking state government and increasing the private sector mm-hmm. workforce.
Yeah, and that focus on state government can have a ripple effect in many other industries, including obviously healthcare and in education. Marilyn from Hallandale Beach is joining us from our Public Insight Network here on WLRN. Marilyn, you're unemployed but highly educated. So tell me, what are the challenges that you're experiencing in this Florida job market?
Well, the challenges that I'm experiencing as an educator is that once you get the higher degrees and the high number of years of experience, you seem to be blacklisted because of the budget cuts. School districts can get two brand new teachers for the price of me, so they prefer to do that. I've only been able to, I started out here as a teacher in Dade County back in 1995. I left the state and I came back. And I've only been able to get part-time work. Mm-hmm. And the excuse or the reason has been budget cuts. And we cannot afford to use our limited budget salaries for a high-priced educator like yourself. I mean, I've got a PhD and 17 years of experience, and it's really, really difficult. Going into the fall, I'm hoping that I get a job, but who knows?
And Dara mentioned Governor Scott's focus on trying to stoke manufacturing here. We know that there's a big focus on technology, engineering, mathematics. Give us an idea, Marilyn, just so we understand what your education, professional experience background is in.
I'm so glad that you asked that. I used to be a pharmaceutical chemist in my first career. I have a bachelor's degree in biology, chemistry, and education, a master's degree in biomedical sciences. I've written an associate's degree biotechnology program for a college in Georgia. I've worked here in the South Florida area prior to 2003. I worked with a prominent pharmaceutical company training their mm-hmm. chemists. I have a PhD, a self-designed quantitative PhD, in the effects of emotions on learning, where I combine neuroanatomy with classroom experiences and use this to differentiate instruction to show how we can promote learning, especially for our marginalized groups.
So there's Marilyn's resume right there, Greg and Dara. I mean, you know, the governor, other politicians, Doug, state, local, municipal, want STEM, science, technology, education, math, such a focus on it in the classrooms, Greg. You get somebody with that kind of experience saying, listen, they can't find a job right now because they're being priced out of the market.
And, you know, it's a tough, you know, conundrum, because it's not like, you know, you can make these jobs appear overnight. I mean, I think to his credit, the governor is obviously wants to create jobs in Florida. His main strategy is one that some people have questioned. It's this one of trying to lure businesses from other states, and the states he's looking to.
They call it poaching, Greg.
Poaching.
They call
it poaching. It is, listen, but, you know, in a competitive market economy, that's to be expected.
Right, and I think it's fair. It's fair game. One does wonder about all the states being Democratic states, but maybe that's just the way the country's made up. That he's looking to states in the north with large populations and with big businesses, and it's not just him. Of course, we know it's Rick Perry has the
in
exact
Texas,
same,
right? The governor of Texas, absolutely.
But also, he's really using Florida's tax structure, which is no income tax and low business tax, to pull companies from these states that have higher taxes, and it's a pretty compelling argument. And, of course, the strategy, you know, it hurts these state workers, but the less money you put into government payroll, the more money you can give back to businesses for tax breaks, et cetera.
Yeah, Richard from Margate is part of our Public Insight Network, also with direct experience in trying to hunt for a job in arguably is still a relatively difficult environment here throughout the state of Florida. Richard, you just graduated recently with a master's degree from UM, but similar to Marilyn, just had difficulty finding work. What have you found?
I had exactly two interviews out of whatever I could find that was actually relevant to my experience. I had two interviews. I was shot down for both. Everything else I applied to has yet to even call me back, if they ever will.
And so are you feeling overqualified after this master's degree?
Well, that's a funny question, because You see, I'm kind of stuck in the middle. Because I have a master's and a bachelor's, I kind of price myself out of, you know, lower skill, lower wage. The minute they see one or both of those degrees, they're going to say, you're overqualified, get out of here. And then that's happened many a time.
Richard from Margate sharing his experiences in the Florida job market with us here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Dara, is this kind of complaint of middle income, higher education folks kind of playing at all with state politicians, state lawmakers, the concern about, you know, median incomes that have been stagnant for many years throughout the nation, certainly even here in Florida, can really begin to hollow out the middle class?
Well, certainly the Democrats are concerned about the demise of the middle class, and they have made a big point of saying that many of the governor's policies have harmed the middle class. I was just thinking, though, you know, I just wrote a story about Palm Beach State College has reduced the hours of its workers who work 30 hours a week to 27 and a half hours a week, and are limiting its adjunct staff to teaching 3 courses per semester to avoid having to comply with the federal health care law that goes into effect in January on January 1st.
Right.
So they would, and we've heard of businesses doing this around the state, and I don't know to what extent that is having a limiting factor on people hiring. I think it's very interesting because the Florida Chamber of Commerce and the Council of 100 and all these and AIF, Associated Industries, business groups have been pushing for more STEM science degrees, and because they keep saying, you know, we can't hire, we don't have an educated enough workforce. But the question is, you know, do we have the infrastructure to support those kinds of degrees? You know, or is that just pie in the sky?
Yeah.
I mean, certainly your former caller seems to indicate it might be more wishful thinking.
We have more contributors from our Public Insight Network. Jay from Coral Springs is along with us here. And Jay, you know, your experience is on the training side of things, that you're not seeing employers willing to invest in their workforce, right?
To some degree, what I'm seeing is that the jobs that I'm looking for, I may hit 3 out of 5 of the qualifications, and what the employers want now is 5 out of 5. I don't think they want to spend the time training. And you've got I'm at the older end of the spectrum, 50 plus, if you will, and I'm not sure if that's an obstacle that I'm running into also.
Well, Jay of Coral Springs, don't think of it as old. Think of it as mature and experienced. It's mature and experienced. We'll play it that way. But, Dara, to your point, in looking at, you know, the role that community colleges may play in this, you know, we hear a lot from employers saying they're not getting a skill set matched between the workforce and the kinds of jobs that they see Florida needs to have in the economy of the future. Isn't that correct?
Well, one of the things that is correct, and one of the things that the governor has asked the colleges to do is to track the number of job, you know, the percentages or the employment rate for each of the majors at the colleges, and I believe it's at the universities as well. But this would be, you know, he wants colleges to offer $10,000 four-year degrees, and he wants them to be able to get for students and parents to look at whatever major it is that they're going to sign up for and say, okay, you know, what are the chances I'm going to get a job if I major in, I'm not going to use anthropology because we've already
or English.
Journalism?
Should we not use journalism either?
Well, you know, fill in the blank. And, you know, and I think that there seems to be support for, it seems like a good idea to say, okay, if I major in this, let me go back to what my grandfather, who was born in Italy in 1898, he always told all of us, and I sadly did not follow his advice, to get a trade. Because you would never go hungry if you got a trade. And I think that part of what this community college, you know, and what they're doing with high schools, even with these certified, I forget what it is, but it's basically you can learn a trade while you're
right.
in high school.
Certificates,
and get some sort of certification. Is you know what? It's Florida. There's always going to be a need for air conditioning repairmen. And they make a good salary, and plumbers and things like that. And so maybe we need to re-educate. We need to a culture change in terms of what higher education means, and what and maybe revalue the idea of having a trade and contributing to society in that way.
That's Derek Cam, Palm Beach Post, with us from Tallahassee. Greg Allen, national correspondent for National Public Radio in South Florida, along with us, and business writer from the Miami Herald, Doug Hanks, here on the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. Of course, when it comes to jobs, we're never too far away from another election cycle. And one, of course, is coming up in the several months ahead, I guess. We still have a little bit of time to recover from the heat victory last night before we have to get into the gubernatorial race. But there had been a new poll out, guys, this week from Quinnipiac University showing that Republican, now Democrat, Charlie Crist, leading Governor Scott by 47% to 37%. Peter Brown of the Polling Institute really calls the poll mixed results for both men.
For Scott, the good news is that 16 points is down to 10, and that he's at his highest levels ever on favorability and job approval. Now, they're not great numbers, but they're better than what they have been.
So, Greg, you know, it's still early in this race, still don't have any official candidates yet, but clearly we're seeing some positioning, at least by the political parties, if not the candidates themselves.
Well, yeah, as we were saying earlier, you know, clearly the candidate that Rick Scott is most concerned about, or at least the Republican Party is most concerned about, is Charlie Crist, who's, you know, only recently become a Democrat, not said that he's running for governor. I think the assumption is he will. Other people actually have said they're running, I guess, including Nan Rich. But what the interesting thing has been on the Democratic side, it's almost like they're afraid they're going to mess it up, because right now Rick Scott is so vulnerable that a good candidate seems like a shoo-in, right? That's with 10 points. Rick Scott, though, as we know, spent $70 million of his own money the last election.
Yep.
It very well might do it this time. He's actually raising really big bucks now. He's going to be a tough candidate. But I think the Democrats are so afraid they could mess it up that they're trying to control the process. And that in itself can cause problems by trying to keep Nan Rich kind of on the sidelines for now and not actually bring her forward at the recent dinner they had.
Mm-hmm.
They opened themselves to charges. They were suppressing candidates. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out and whether Charlie Crist will be the strong candidate that certainly the Republicans think he will be.
Well, we were talking about politics and state jobs here, and Tom joins us on the line here from Alligator Alley. Tom, welcome to the Florida Roundup. What's your question?
Thank you. No, I want to know if there's any talk about who the lieutenant governor is going to be. I know that, Scott went above 40, still below. He has more unfavorable. Maybe he figures he doesn't need somebody.
Possibly here. Dara, how about it? Any update on the lieutenant governor position?
We have not heard anything official. I saw someone tweet this morning. I think it was Peter Schorsch from St. Peter's blog tweeted this morning that it could be George Lemieux. We saw an odd picture of George Lemieux and Governor Scott in France at this trade mission. And the reason that I say it was odd is because, I mean, it was sort of like George Lemieux popped up from
the past.
Nowhere.
He was like the garden gnome all of a sudden
showing up
in the picture. He photobombed the governor.
I'm not saying that. And of course he was, he was the maestro for Charlie Crist, mm-hmm. and has that could help out. But I wanted to go back to what Greg said about, the Democrats not wanting to mess it up. Let's face it, Charlie Crist is, wide speculation that he is going to enter the governor's race, mm-hmm. at some point after Labor Day. He carries a lot of baggage. He was a lifelong Republican. He was a conservative Republican. He was McCain. He helped McCain in Florida in 08. And the longer that you can delay the onslaught of attacks on the Democrats, best hope being a lifelong Republican turned independent turned Democrat, is probably to their advantage. Of course, it also delays the amount of time that they have to organize and get and raise money.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that Charlie Crist does bring to the table is he is apparently close with the Obama administration, and it was the Obama team that really won that election in 2012 for the president in Florida. And so, you know, if they can capitalize on the Obama team for the governor's race, that helps the Democrats out a great deal in a midterm election.
But look what Rick Scott has going for him. Housing values are going to be better.
Mm-hmm.
The economy is going to be better, and the budget process is going to get easier. I mean, the economic wins are behind him.
Well, he had the good fortune of winning the governor's mansion at a time when the economy was bottoming, certainly. So he's been able to play this economic cycle up for political benefits, and we're likely to hear a lot of that come.
But couldn't Crist have been there? I mean, that would have been his recovery.
That's right. Absolutely.
That's right.
All right. We've got to move on here beyond politics. Plenty of other news to hit the headlines in the week ahead. The George Zimmerman second-degree murder trial. Opening statements are due to begin next week. Greg Allen will be there, but we've got him now, and we'll talk more about it coming up on the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson in for Phil Latzman. We've got Doug Hanks, business writer from the Miami Herald. Derek Hamm from the Palm Beach Post with us from Tallahassee, where she follows Floridian politics. And Greg Allen, national correspondent for NPR. Greg, you will be up in Central Florida, I imagine, on Monday, getting prepared for the opening statements in the George Zimmerman trial. We do have the jury selected. Six women will determine whether Zimmerman committed second-degree murder when the former Neighborhood Watch volunteer shot and killed Miami Gardens teen Trayvon Martin. What strikes you about the jury selection process to get to this point today?
Well, of course, you know, Tom, as you know, it's six jurors because you only need 12 for if there's a capital case. And since capital punishment won't be involved here, six is all they need. And that's puzzled some people. But one would think that might make it a little bit easier to have a unanimous jury than if you have 12 you have to convince one way or the other. That's one issue. The fact that it's all women is interesting. The prosecution was moving to strike a number of jurors yesterday during the jury selection process, and the defense objected, saying they were just striking them just because they're women.
Hmm.
Well, if you looked at the pool was overwhelmingly female, and then you saw the jury we ended up with, six women, five of them are white, one is a Hispanic woman, and then you have four alternates. There are two men on the alternate panel.
Right.
So we'll see how that plays out. I think both sides could say that having women on the jury will help them. I'm not sure who it does.
Well, the defense attorney, Mark O'Mara, in fact, says he called the jury selection process fair.
The state struck the first black juror, and then we got our six. I had questions about two black jurors on their ability to be fair and impartial, and we've talked about that. That's been, I think, now put on record as to my thoughts, and the judge agreed.
Now, Greg, it's often said that a case can be won or lost in jury selection even before you get to the evidence and the arguments. With that in mind, any sense of kind of how this jury is going to absorb this case?
Well, the main thing that they seemed to talk about during the 2 days of questioning of the final group of jurors was just, will you follow the process? Will mm-hmm. do you not come in with preconceptions? And they talked about everything from guns, from having concealed carry permit, how do you feel about neighborhood watch programs, how do you feel about the value of someone's life, a teenager versus an older person. Race came into it briefly in the questioning, but was pretty much taken out because the jurors all agreed the race had nothing to do with the race of the victim or the perpetrator, had nothing to do here with the outcome of the case.
But we may hear about race, at least in the opening statements, which of course we know are not to be considered as evidence. Today, in fact, there was a hearing this morning where the judge agreed that words like profiling, wannabe cop, and vigilante can be used in those opening statements on Monday.
Right, but you cannot say racial profiling, and that was a motion that the defense brought forward. Mark O'Mara, Zimmerman's attorney, said that they should not use certain terms, vigilante, wannabe cop, racial profiling, he said. The judge said he can say both those things, wannabe cop, he can say profiling, but just not racial profiling. So the idea is you can profile someone not based on race alone, and if that's the intention, then that would be permissible. The other interesting thing, the judge said that the prosecution could could say in the opening arguments that George Zimmerman confronted Trayvon Martin. Mm. And that issue is really at the center of the case. When these two people met, who started the fight? And then when you say confronted, that suggests that, at least from the prosecution's point of view, that George Zimmerman sparked the confrontation.
Another interesting procedural point here, Greg, is this argument over verbiage even before it's said in open court. Right. So in other words, normally I would imagine these opening statements would be heard and then the defense or prosecution would object to those statements while they're being heard.
Well, there's different rules for opening statements than there are for the rest of the testimony, for witness testimony, in that that it does not, you don't have to have proven it, have evidence behind it. And so since the rules have so much more leeway, the judge was saying, I'm not going to tell the prosecutors what they can say unless you can really point out to me why we need to do this. And so that's why she pretty much gave deference to the prosecutors in that.
Yeah.
And she said, then you can come back later and say in the closing, say the prosecutors never made their, they never followed up on their assertion in the openings. This is what you do. And so it's all about jockeying, trying to control the process.
One thing that we still don't know quite yet is whether or not the jury is going to hear from experts about the 911 call recordings, when prosecution audio experts have suggested, at least in some of the pretrial hearings, that the recording indicates that Trayvon Martin was crying out in fear.
Does he look hurt?
I can't see him. I don't want to go out there. I don't know what's going on. So they're sending.
So you think he's yelling help?
Yes.
All right, what is your number?
Just gunshots.
It's pretty chilling even to hear it today, isn't it, Dara?
It is. Everyone is very anxious to find out what's going to happen with the testimony, whether the judge is going to allow those expert witness testimony. I was just thinking on the state level, this at one point was thought to be, the Florida Stand Your Ground law was going to be on trial, and we still don't know, right, Greg, whether they intend to use that at some point?
Well, I think it's clear that the Stand Your Ground defense will come in there somehow, just in the arguments, but it'll be determined that it's all about Florida's law of self-defense, and Florida's Stand Your Ground law was read to the jurors yesterday to make sure they understood it and that they would be able to adhere to uphold Florida's Stand Your Ground law. So I think it will in some way, shape, or form come in, just not in a separate hearing.
You know, we are going to impose and perhaps reflect a lot on this jury as this process goes forth here, Greg. As you know, I've actually served on a jury in a first-degree murder trial. And I got to say, as the jury goes back into closed discussions, the things that I guess the outside community thinks they may be discussing, gender, role of race, all of these kinds of things, never really enters into the argument, because most citizens are going to take jury selection and jury duty like this very seriously. And Doug, to that point, we won't know what that kind of discussion is going on inside that room during the case, let alone once the case has ended and they go into that deliberation process.
No, but we'll know pretty soon after they're done, correct? Because I've always been amazed at how quickly the media can get hold of the jury members and say, what were you thinking? What happened?
Yeah. There are jury members who are on the initial pool of 40 that are now being interviewed, who right. come out. So we've started to come beyond that. If I might, Tom, on that question of the 911 tape, just to be clear, we're waiting for the judge might come down later today to rule on which, if any, audio experts can testify about who they think is heard yelling. Mm-hmm. And the question is, it's almost like for the public, it's almost like a Rorschach test about who's heard yelling, because it's really not clear at all to me at this point who's heard yelling. I can hear convincing arguments both ways. I don't know Trayvon Martin's voice, or I've heard George Zimmerman speak, but yelling, as we've heard from many experts, is so different. The way the voice, the way that the sound is constructed by your lungs, by your vocal cords, is so different in a yelling thing that you cannot compare it. That's one of the contentions of some of the experts. They say you cannot tell. And you've got, on the other hand, the prosecutor, who has some experts who say they believe that it's not George Zimmerman. One says he believes it actually is Trayvon Martin. That's why this ruling will be key. If you can't have an expert coming in saying whose voice it is, then you'll be left with the families saying that Trayvon Martin's parents saying that's our son, and you'll have George Zimmerman's father saying that's my son, and it'll be up to the jury to decide. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, and it could be actually key to it'll be a key moment in the case when that tape is played and we see the reactions of the jury and the witnesses.
One thing I think is interesting, because obviously this is getting so much attention nationally, I think it really captures the difference in the gun control debate, because you do not hear a big debate in terms of what would have happened if Zimmerman did not have a firearm with him? And I think if it had been 20 years ago in the 90s, that really would have been the debate. I mean, that would have been the big discussion as opposed to everything else we're talking about. It seems to me that's almost taken out of the equation. I don't know if people feel that's the case.
But for many people, this is not just a case about George Zimmerman's guilt or innocence. It is a case. It is you know, race relations in Florida. It is about guns
This is where I got to disagree. Serving on a jury in a murder case, I have to say none of that enters into the conversation within the jury room. Jurors have an incredible ability to set aside any prejudices as they're directed to by the judge and consider the case solely on the merits of the evidence.
Maybe not in the jury room, but in the eyes of the people watching this.
I agree with, yes.
And that's where the jury's composition comes into it. I mean, I think that Mark O'Meara defended the jury selection. You know, he struck two African-American women from the alternate pool and was called on it by the state in the courtroom and explained very clearly in the courtroom why he was excluding them, not on, on gender or race grounds. And they both had connections to some part of the what he perceived to be some connection to some part of the process already that could act to prejudice them. So he argued that and said the process intends it to be fair. That's fine, but you still have six. You don't have an African American member on the jury in a Sanford. Of course, is like nearly a third African American. Mm-hmm. Seminole County is about it's about 10% or so. That's going to come end up being an issue in the end within certain sectors of the community watching this trial.
Without question.
Yeah, certainly this is a case that all of Florida is watching, if not the nation. Greg Allen from National Public Radio will be there. Coverage in the Miami Herald, coverage here on WLRN, coverage in the Palm Beach Post, no doubt about it. I do want to end this Friday Florida Roundup here on a little bit of a lighter note, a bit of an astrological phenomenon that's going to happen for all of us here in South Florida this weekend. It is a super moon. Jim Masterson of Florida Atlantic University's Harbor Branch Oceanographic Institute explains it this way.
As the moon is coming up over the horizon, it's going to look much larger than it normally does. That's an optical illusion.
And yet the moon still is closer to the United States, closer to the Earth as it ever is, coming up on Sunday night. So we've got the heat wind, we've got the jobless rate down, and now we've got the super moon. So is this a trifecta of sorts, Greg Allen, that we need to be wary of in South Florida, where, let's face it, some strange things can happen?
And add into the heat championship, it's the fourth thing. You know, I mean, it's a time for things to come together. You got to read the Rolling Stone article this week, the American Atlantis.
Right. So what Greg is referring to there is a long article in Rolling Stone talking about Miami being underwater in the year 2030 after a fictional hurricane comes and blows through town in Fort Lauderdale and blows away most of the beach and because of rising sea level. But this is a significant, very real concern. This is not some fictional concern that Rolling Stone journalist dug kind of brought up and for public discussion. Rising sea level is a fact of life here.
And I'll tell you what, if that really catches the public imagination and continues, as we're starting to hear more bubbling about it, it's going to be a big, big deal when it comes to real estate prices here.
Yep. And how about it, Dara, from a legislative point of view, is rising sea level and climate change playing at all in Tallahassee?
Oh, my goodness, no. I mean, look at the makeup?
That was a loaded
question. They won't even talk about climate change.
Yeah. Tallahassee's at a much higher elevation, too.
Well, you'll see the governor tweet about jobs and tweet about the heat, but not tweet about rising sea level. We've got to leave it there, guys. It's the Florida Roundup here on this Friday on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson in for Phil Latzman. Doug Hanks from the Miami Herald, thank you so much, Doug. Greg Allen from NPR joining us from South Dade County, and Dara Kam from the Palm Beach Post joining us from Tallahassee. Lots more online. You can continue that discussion at WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup today, produced by Marva Hinton and Elaine Chen. Our intern, Isabel Echarte. Our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow. Our social media editor, Danny Riviero. We've got our executive producer, for WLRN, Peter Mayers. And for WLRN Miami Herald News, Dan Gretsch, our news director. Our technical supervisor on this, the Friday Florida Roundup, is Paul Leary, doing a fantastic job behind the board. We've got plenty more to come. You can join us, of course, online on Facebook and Saturday morning at 6 a.m. for the Florida Roundup. South Florida Arts Beat is next. I'm Tom Hudson, and thanks for listening.